is. If the addition of DNSSEC to normal zone maintenance raises the threshold so that it is no longer something that can be done casually out of the back pocket by a part-time system administrator using a spreadsheet or whatever. We're talking about the low end of the scale, not the high end where it's all done formally with good tools and a lot of attention. Then we might see a shift in which some of the zones that would have been maintained individually and casually get outsourced to professional zone maintainers. And I'd like to find a way to measure that, actually. I think that would be an interesting, although it'll probably be a somewhat subtle effect to see over a period of time. Let's see. I think that's happy to come back to any of these, but those are the ones. There's the last batch. Here there's only six. Reporting of DNSSEC problems, we don't have any organized mechanisms for aggregating these, but the community does talk to each other. And I don't know how much more there is to say about that, except yes, it would be a good idea to have a more organized forums. The last item on that list is getting validators to remove the PIR trust anchor after the root is signed. So the fear that has been raised is that there's a trust anchor repository, or more than one, that has the top-level key, the key signing key, for PIR, in this case for .org. And then the root is signed, and it signs the key signing key for the DS record for .org. But the existing entries in the existing trust anchor repositories are not removed, and so there is competition and confusion as to which source is the right one. And then if there's a key rollover, it may be inconsistent, and it may be rolled over under the root but not under the tars. My view of that is that trust anchor repositories should be run in a way that is sort of anticipates this kind of issue and does not, where they don't go into business trying to compete with signed zones. There's a lot of controversy about trust anchor repositories in general, and so I think it's really part of that discussion. Let me switch to the other, to the next topic. I mentioned that, let's see, how many people are familiar here? This is the heart of where the issue came up about the cities of Gavla and another one. Have I pronounced this the city, the name of the city correctly? So my understanding is that a version of Bind was released which had this peculiar effect of returning a signed response whenever it could, even if it wasn't asked for. And that generated many more signed responses than would otherwise have been seen. And the impact was unexpected in that some of the end system devices could not handle them, and so that caused a disruption in service. And in particular, the city of Gavla and one other city that I don't remember. I'm sorry? Is it louder? Okebu? Oh, I'm sorry. Stopped being visible. And so I don't know how important those towns were before, but they became very important all at once. The immediate fix, of course, was to fix that version of Bind so that it didn't return unsigned responses when they weren't asked for. But, of course, the question of, oh, my goodness, what happens when people do ask for signed responses and get them back, then their service will be disrupted. So that's a quite serious concern. The group here, and my understanding is, Patrick, this was primarily your work, yes, did a study of several routers and firewalls and found numerous problems, published a very nice report. We looked at that, and the folks at Nominet looked at that. And concurrently, we each initiated studies, which we then, when we discovered that we were doing both interested in exactly the same thing, fused our efforts to produce a common study that worked out, I must say, spectacularly well. Perfect cooperation, perfect splitting up of the work. We hired Lisa Pfeiffer at Core Competence, and she worked with Ray Bellis at Nominet, and the partnership was as good as anything I could have hoped for. 24 devices were selected and tested, and also coordinated with Patrick on to make sure that the tests were consistent and moved to the next step. So, and the general question is, what's the impact of DNSSEC on consumer class broadband routers? Here's a, there's a published report, all the data, test methodology, details on the firmware, which versions, which models, everything is available, published in multiple places. I believe Nominet has it published. We put it on the ICANN website as an SAC report, and anybody who can't find it, you're welcome to ask, and we're happy to make it available. The purpose of this chart is not so that you should jot down furiously little details, but I wanted to give a kind of the flavor of the basic results. One of the key things that distinguished one of these devices from another is whether it attempted to act as its own DNS name server or whether it would pass requests upward that would come through. And some of the devices would only operate in the so-called route mode, that is, they would pass the device, the request through. Many of the devices would operate as their own DNS server, and those fell into three subcategories. Some would initially come up in that mode and stay in that mode, but could be configured. Let me be back up and say this more carefully. They would come up and they would also supply DHCP service. And if somebody requested an IP address, they would also be given the address of that box as a DNS server. Whereas a box that's operating in what I'm calling route mode, when an answer to DHCP request would hand out an IP address, but it would hand out the address of the upstream DNS server. Some of the boxes come up initially in proxy mode, that is, acting as their own DNS server when asked for the name of a DNS server, but could be manually changed over so that they would give a different answer. And some of them would automatically switch over once they had acquired the address of an upstream DNS server. So we have some that... And some would just stay in proxy mode unless you change it. Some would stay in proxy mode and could not be reconfigured to switch over to route mode. However, if a request was directed to an upstream DNS server, it would be sent there under all circumstances so that none of them insisted on trapping and answering DNS queries. So that is the first column there, or the second column, out-of-the-box usage mode, and you have some that are routes, some that are proxy, and some that are marked as varies. And then the next two columns are how they behaved in each of those modes. And over in the middle, you see quite a few red and yellow entries marked fail, or fail for packet sizes greater than some number, 512, 1500, 1472, and so forth. We gave clean marks only to a router that required no work whatsoever out of the box, plug it in, turn it on, and use it, whether or not it's in proxy mode or route mode. But if you had to reconfigure it, then we scored it differently. And so here's the condensation, here's the summary of what we discovered. Out of the 24 devices selected, three of them operated only in route mode. Six of the devices started in proxy mode, switched to route mode once the upstream wide area network link is up. But this leads to a chicken and egg problem that after that happens, future clients will are sending packets through it, routing them upstream, but prior clients, before it's acquired the upstream DNS server, are still treating the local device, this local router, as a DNS server. Six of the devices start out in proxy mode, but could be configured to be in route mode so that if you didn't like its behavior in proxy mode and you have control of the device, if you're the local system administrator, if you will, then you could set it up so that it would be always in route mode. That is, it would always give the upstream DNS server. Nine of the devices start out in proxy mode and cannot be configured not to do that. And as I said before, all of these devices permit clients to route through them if the client overrides the DHCP setting for the DNS service. And here's the summary of the results, and they are not too comfortable. Out of the 24 devices, six of them, for various reasons, operating in various modes, operate seamlessly out of the box. Nine of them could be configured so that they would not be pose a problem. So that's a total of 15 out of the 24 that don't pose any issue to the client, six without any attention, and nine if the local system administrator brings them up properly. Of the remaining nine, seven worked okay if the client routed a packet through it, and even so, there were two that, and there's some question about all this, but I took the most conservative view. Two are marked here as having problems even if the client is sending packets through them. Some issues about either packet size in one case or what appears on later examination to be kind of a bug in the software, memory leak and just failing, which may or may not be related to DNSSEC and just may be a more general bug. But in any case, from a consumer experience point of view, is not good news. In my view, these numbers are not good enough. On the other hand, the tests are visible, they are compelling, and I believe, I would hope, that over the next several months, both major vendors will get the picture and start adjusting the firmware in their things. None of these require fundamental changes in the hardware. I think that these are fundamentally software issues. And the other major point of leverage are ISPs that either select boxes that go to their customers or recommend or give qualifications to various customers. We met with key people at Comcast 2 weeks ago, and I mentioned that we had done this study, and I was really quite pleasantly surprised.